But you're out ahead in August. You're out ahead in September. If you were in the Hebrew University, you could have two. If you didn't like one, you could take a second. But that is the University of Wisconsin. So, I don't know why you're hissing. You get the final. We have all agreed, all three of us. And Mr. Weinberg, despite of his miserable defeat in miniature golf yesterday, has agreed that it is a brilliant final. You have something to look forward to. So, now anyway, last time I talked about specific reactions of certain groups to the Jewish policy to 1938-39. Or rather, if you want to put it that way, the specific actions of the Jewish groups to the first phase of Nazi anti-Jewish policy. And I talked about the majority liberals, about rightist groups, and finally about the Zionists. Clearly, by 1939, when the squeeze really came, the Jews were disunited. All the emphases and choices of previous Jewish history came into play and were not overcome. They were never really to be overcome. The ideal of assimilation was deep and had been too successful in the West. But even for many notables in the East, to just put behind. Moreover, I must mention the kind of optimism which was really involved in all Jewish choices throughout the past history. Whether you think of the ethic of socialism, Zionism, or liberalism, or even nationalist assimilation, all these choices were essentially optimistic choices. That is, they depended on an outlook in the world that was entirely optimistic and then assumed a solution, whatever that solution might be. As I told you last time, in the Jewish adult education procedures under Nazi pressure, the prophets were stressed in a way to emphasize this optimism. An optimism not for tomorrow, that looked too bleak, but for the day after tomorrow, certainly. And that made it very difficult to even comprehend the idea of mass murder. Jews, therefore, were unprepared. Not only is everyone caught up in its own myths, whether it is liberalism, assimilationism, or Zionism, but you must remember also the techniques used to solve the Jewish question. The gradualism, the system, the depersonalization. And you must remember, finally, that there was really no compact Jewish community. For any resistance, compactness and cohesion is certainly a prerequisite. But such compactness and cohesion did not exist, certainly not in the West, where there wasn't even territorial compactness and cohesion. But it didn't even exist in Eastern Europe. You have read the family Moscow. There is very little to be seen of any cohesion of the Jewish group which made resistance possible. Moreover, in Poland, another factor comes into this equation. Many Jews had fought with the Polish army in 1939. And these Jews were shattered by the defeat of Poland, as were the other Poles. To this, we must now add another factor of which we must speak at greater length, namely the particular technique used to control the Jewish community and in fact to induce a cohesion which had never before existed. For the Nazis believed, and as we shall see, dangerously, that cohesion in the Jewish community was essential to solve the Jewish question. And you have seen how in Germany, from 1933 on, you have a central body, the so-called Reichsvertretung, which I told you about last time. But in Poland also, immediately, Jewish councils were set up. But these Jewish councils, which in Germany until 1938 had really a great deal of autonomy, they were controlled not by the secret police, not by the SS, but by lawyers, by not according to the Nuremberg laws, which meant that they had, in fact, quite a lot of elbow room. But in 1939, the SS and the secret police took over the control of the Reichsvertretung in Germany and of the Jewish councils. Immediately they were set up in Poland in 1939. Now, into this system, compliance was built, because what this system was really, on the surface, was Jewish self-government under Nazi command. But it still, in spite of the fact that the Nazis appointed the elders, all the notables, it was still Jewish command. And no Nazi organism ever dealt directly with individual Jews. This is very important again to remember. Individual Jews, whether for territorial concentration or later on for deportation, were always dealt with through the Jewish councils. In other words, it was Jewish self-government by Nazi command. And in this, there was a great deal of compliance built in, because the people the Nazis appointed were in fact the old leadership. That is to say, the Nazis made no changes in the Jewish community structure at all, but they simply took over the old leadership and appointed. So that for most individual Jews, within the structure of the Jewish community, there was a sameness and no change. And the directives came from the community itself, not from a Nazi organization. The Jewish councils, or Judenräte, were responsible for the execution of the commands, and they were, of course, responsible with their lives, eventually, in fact, in short order. However, here again, it must be clearly understood that the procedure is by steps. In Poland, first the appointment after the appointment of the Jewish council. They were first made responsible for territorial concentration in 1940. That is to say, to get the Jews to form compact settlements. This did not bode particularly evil at the time, and the compliance with this was, as a matter of fact, relatively smooth. But the second step soon followed, the creation of ghettos, late in 1940. The creation of ghettos, which were now not only for Poles, but for all Jews who were deported there. And the Polish Jewish Council, therefore, in fact, became responsible for most of European Jewry. But in effect, the ghettos were for all. But that was the second step. And the third step was then the deportation from the ghetto to the extermination camps. That also, and I will come back to it in a minute, was done by the Jewish Council. Poland was, after all, to be the scene of the final solution. Not only, let me remind you, because secrecy was easier maintained, Auschwitz these camps were very isolated, but also because of numbers. Remember, Warsaw had as many Jews as the whole of Germany, almost 400,000. Warsaw alone had as many Jews as almost the whole of Germany. The German figure was 600,000. So the numbers also made it the logical place. But for the Nazis here, ideologically, and that always played a big part, was the reservoir of world Jewry, of which, after all, the protocols of the elders of Zion had talked, as you know. The ghettos were started in Lodz, Lemberg, in 1940, and the moves were according to a strict schedule, and they were therefore under the auspices of the Judenrat. What we notice therefore about the Jewish councils, that they were given more and more awesome tasks. First, concentration, then ghetto, then the drawing up of lists for deportation. For the deportation lists were compiled from the only lists available, and those were the lists maintained by the Jewish communities. This was true in Poland. It was also true for the deportation from the West to Poland, for example, for the list of the Berlin Jewish community. Thus, the Judenrat were prepared for their final task in camps and ghettos. Namely, finally, they were directly involved in selecting people for extermination. The membership of these councils were the nobles, that is to say, the traditional leadership of the community, which, as I said a minute ago, the Nazis just took over. These men, of course, were not trained in any kind of resistance. Professionally, they were mostly lawyers, industrialists, and engineers. But we must remember here what engineer meant in Eastern Europe. Engineer in Eastern Europe was the pinnacle of academic achievement. Engineer in Eastern Europe had a very great prestige to it. So they were lawyers, engineers, industrialists. For example, the chief of the Warsaw Ghetto was an engineer. Nazi pressure upon them was always applied gradually and increasingly, as in all the other matters concerned with the Jewish question. In the ghetto stage, the mortality rate was as yet not as high. It has been estimated that ghettos accounted for the death of about one-fourth of the Polish Jewish population. Now, there are several ways, obviously, at looking at these Judenrat. There is Hannah Arendt's famous point that it would have been quite different if the Judenrat had not existed, and if there had been no list of Jews and no Jewish organization. On the face of it, this is, I think, a proper point. For where it did not exist, as in Italy, when the Germans came in, there were large-scale escapes from persecution. Those of you who read Pax's book on the Black Sabbath will, after all, remember that. There were no lists, the community did not really collaborate, and many, many Jews could, after all, escape. But in a sense, this point is irrelevant, really, because there was no choice, given the fact of the psychology of the community leaders, the respectability, the, if you like to call it this way, embourgeoisement of the whole community. You were dealing after here, after all, in dealing with the Jews, you were dealing with a group which essentially, I dare say, was more embourgeoisie that is to say, more integrated in the bourgeoisie than any other group in Europe. This comes through assimilation, through the way things went about, through the acceptance of citizenship. And once given this kind of thing, it was obviously irrelevant to say that there should have been no organization. What we have instead is just the contrary. What Jews did from 33 was to withdraw into their organization. Not only was there a fight against organization, there wasn't such a thing as a fight against organization, but instead Jews actually withdrew into their organization. This is totally understandable under the circumstances, but it did mean providing an instrument for the solution of the Jewish question. It meant that, on this I think you cannot really get around, that the Jews themselves provided the instrument of their destruction. Or perhaps the Jews can put it a little better, that the Jews themselves provided the instrument which the Nazis used for their destruction. Which again made it much easier, because depersonalized. If your instructions came from fellow Jews, if you were policed by fellow Jews, this obviously made it much easier than if the Nazis would have had to do it themselves and placed directly into the problem of resistance. As with everything, and you should have learned that by now, the Nazis made it into a system. It was part of this emphasis on system and perfection. Indeed, we notice throughout this whole process, the more impersonal, the better. The more part of a bureaucratic or other system, the better. Remember one thing, please, that the organizer of it all was par excellence the bureaucrat. The man who organized it all was Heinrich Müller. And I have already told you how Müller loyally served the Republic and then the Nazis. In other words, it was always a bureaucratic mechanism. You can see this quite clearly in the way the killings came about. Until 1940, the murders were done by shooting. This was very undesirable. First of all, you get mutinies among shooting commanders. Second of all, the German army protests right up to Hitler. And thirdly, it had a personal side to it. You saw the victims. The victims were right in front of you. The second stage was already regarded as a big improvement in impersonalization. The second stage, which comes in 1940, are the famous vans. Now gas is used in mobile vans. And the contact with the victim is still there, because the vans were necessarily small, but it is already depersonalized. And certainly, the gas chamber is invented. Eventually, in fact, in 1941, 42, a general rejoicing among the SS, because that meant total depersonalization, total impersonalization. Now you did not have to come into contact with the victim at all. So that you have always the tendency towards a depersonalized system. Not only, therefore, were the victims depersonalized, to this I'll come in a minute, but the whole system of Jewish policy from the beginning was a bureaucratic, depersonalized system. This again plays into the problem of resistance. For when Jews became a coherent community, it was finally under that kind of condition. Before that, there had never been a coherent community. And the resistance, even in the ghetto, is confined to youth groups, youth movements. And it is, of course, and not to the elder who had been through all the proceedings of previous Jewish history. It's confined to youth groups. But even so, the resistance is by that time, of course, a resistance of desperation, a resistance which has no chance whatever of success before it. We shall come back. All these elements are tied together, and much of the history we've learned, I hope. If we look for a minute at Jewish behavior in the concentration camps, and Jewish behavior in the ghetto, but it's easier for a minute to look at Jewish behavior in the concentration camp. That situation is again what we might call properly an extreme situation, because I'm using both concentration camps and the ones that became extermination camps. They are not very different in their organization. For what turned it out quite clearly from all the reports is that at that point the Jews had no reserves to draw, that their world had too totally collapsed, and that this lack of reserves, this total collapse of their world, was encouraged by Nazi methods of entry into the concentration camp. In other words, when you arrived from Katakas, which was already a terrible experience, you were undressed, you had to parade nude. All of these things, for which the reason really was to give you from the beginning a terrific shock, which is a terrific shock if you think that these Jews came from bourgeois security, from bourgeois society. So from the beginning, the total collapse was emphasized quite consciously by Nazi techniques, above all the techniques used before you ever entered the camp itself. At that point, the very idea of Judaism becomes crucial. And it becomes crucial, the debate, whether Judaism in this situation did not give them reserves, and why it didn't. But in all the changes we have discussed, was there indeed such an idea of like Judaism still present? Was there still a specific idea of being a Jew that could have given Jews in the camp a new pride and, more important, a group cohesion? It is a fact that the Jews in the camp never attained group cohesion, that the only group in concentration camps which attained group cohesion and which managed to keep it throughout were the communists. The communists in camp had cohesion from the first and kept it throughout the entire camp experience. Jews never did. Never. There was not even any cohesion here. We have an analysis, for example, two analyses on which I will now have to base what I say, which are detailed analysis, but you must realize where they come from. One is Adler's book on Theresienstadt. Now, Theresienstadt was the model camp. That is the camp which the Nazis put up in Czechoslovakia in order to put in those Jews who had international reputation, those Jews who had protection, and above all Jews who were very old. In other words, it was the camp of the prominent people. And therefore, it wasn't quite the same as other camps. That must be clear. It was in many ways the same, but not quite, the camp in Theresienstadt, about an hour from Prague, in an old fortress. And the other detailed analysis is by Kolb on Bergen-Belsen. And again, here we have quite a different kind of camp. Bergen-Belsen was supposed to be a transit camp. It was a collecting camp for those Jews who had valid exit visas.
mostly to the United States, but also to part of Latin America. But Bergen-Belsen, as the war went on, and as most people couldn't leave, did tend to become more and more the normal kind of concentration camp. Now, in what I'm telling you now, the interesting thing is that Adler and Kolb agree that whether we talk about the model camp or a quite different camp, the essential pattern still seems alike. And it is Adler who sums it up, and this is, I think, very important for what we have studied and what happened. As Adler puts it in this way, nobody's Judaism changed. Each one was merely strengthened in his old stand, whether he was assimilationist or nationalist. In other words, the camp really made no change. It didn't give cohesion. It tended to reinforce the kind of stand one had taken on Jewish matters in the outside world. This is a tribute, of course, if you like, to the strength of the myth in which each one of us lives. But what has bothered so many people, rightly so, that in such extreme situation there was no renaissance of Judaism as a religion or a culture. And that is still more astounding, because in Theresian times, in most camps, Jews were allowed to get together for the purposes of adult education. In every camp, Jews form adult education groups. And if you see what these adult education groups did and what they discussed, it has very little to do with Judaism. For example, if you take the Theresian Stadt themes, they run all the way from international history to Spinoza. And in a sense, Spinoza is the nearest it comes to any really specific Jewish discussion. And Spinoza, of course, is in a way a model of assimilation, indeed. A model of assimilation. They did at times, especially under the influence of Leo Beck, when he came to Theresienstadt, eventually, try and celebrate Jewish festivals, things of that nature. But from what we know, this was never, as we would say, a very great success. Now, obviously, this has caused a great deal of controversy of one sort or another. But it is a fact that most courses in the camps dealt with secular cultural subjects. What it really means is that slavery, which this was, did not further the consciousness of Judaism under these extreme circumstances on the part of people who, for very good psychological reasons, in this extreme situation, reaffirm their own ideologies from the outside. We can therefore, and this is at the maximum, not answer affirmatively that the camps led to a renaissance of Judaism or indeed produced a cohesion which had been so far absent from Jewish history. Indeed, the enforced community exacerbated the enmities which had always existed on the outside. And obviously, the SS did its best to encourage it. For here we come to the other part of it, and perhaps the most important explanation of the matter. The SS encouraged divide and rule. Not only did they encourage the quarrel between the Orthodox and the Reform, the assimilationists and the Zionists, and there were fights everywhere on these issues too, but rather it is the matter of sheer survival. The main problems in the camps are the following. You must be aware of that. The lack of space and the problem of food. These were the chief problems of survival, the lack of space and the problem of food. Now, these were matters of sheer survival, and to accentuate the struggle, the SS introduced what we would call protection. Some people were treated differently than others. The leadership, but almost anyone, uprooted, got more food, more space. This made for hatred and division, obviously. Because in a situation which is a survival situation, this kind of thing leads to a kind of blind hatred and division, especially, I must say again, by people who have never been used to discipline as the communists have been used to discipline. And among them it did not lead to a breakdown. But among Jews coming from something quite different, this was obviously true, hatred and rivalry, and at the same time, a total dependence upon the SS, who could make you die of starvation, who could make you treat you better, who could give you little space or give you more space. So let me get to this phenomena, which is, in fact, a childlike dependence upon the SS. That we must never forget. A childlike dependence, which again does not make for cohesion. For the SS became, in a sense, the all-present father figure. And therefore that itself prevented any internal cohesion among people who were, as I have tried to make clear, so split and so linked, and who split the SS did, of course, everything, as I have said, to encourage. A definite camp hierarchy existed. Don't forget that. A definite camp hierarchy existed. And it was a matter of survival to become part of that hierarchy. And obviously, it was a matter of hatred for those who were going to survive, if you were not going to survive. That, I think, must be quite clear. Finally, we must remember that the Jews were not among themselves. The Jews were in not only with political prisoners, who behaved exemplarily on the whole, but they were also in with professional criminals. And the leader of the bloc, that is, the leader of the dormitory, the bloc, was always a professional criminal. So that, in fact, the Jews were not even among themselves, really. The person on whom their life totally depended, which was the leader of the bloc, for he could denounce anybody, he could beat somebody to death, didn't really matter, was a professional criminal who was not a Jew. So that Jews were not among themselves, and cohesion was therefore further prevented. You have, therefore, a whole series of facts which led, instead of cohesion and resistance, to a process of depersonalization. Now it seems to me that the question whether Judaism could revive under such adverse circumstances is, in a way, an irrelevant question. It is a question of a mystique. It is a question which is, in a way, a silly question. Those who were Orthodox before the camps remained Orthodox in the camps. And that was always, by now, a small minority. Those who were not were part of this general camp. Moreover, the stripping away of personality meant, in fact, that, as Bruno Bettelheim has said, people became living corpses. There was nothing human about anymore. And that is the final result when you are discussing it in terms of, as it were, in terms of resistance. Now, I realize again that you have never seen people from whom all humanity was stripped. I myself
Sam Norris have seen this when I myself worked in displaced person camp right after the war. And it is difficult to describe to you, because the people who had survived and who came out of the camps, and who are a pretty good model of what the camps made of people, were in the end stripped of anything that could really be called human, because they had done nothing else, after all, and struggled in a most basic animalistic level for survival. And not only that, they had also, of course, been divided in all this by the SS. So when you came to work in this camp by the name of Fernwald, the matter was an extremely serious one. And of course, the astonishing thing, if you came from the outside in security, was again what I have stressed always. There was no revival of Judaism. There was no real cohesion. The quarrels in the camp were bitter. I mean, in this DP camp, were bitter and very difficult to handle, very difficult indeed. So, on the whole, you didn't have really, even when you came out there, into relative freedom, because this camp had open doors, people went in and out. You didn't really have Jewish cohesion in any meaningful manner, reviving, nor did you have, of course, a revival of Judaism, at least that I could ever detect. Now, in all of this, the depersonalization process meant that people withdrew. That is really what I've been trying to do. They withdrew either into their Jewish organization, made it easier for them. They withdrew into their earlier selves, which had existed when they were still free, which also made it easier for the Nazis. Or they became depersonalized in the end and had what psychologically we would call nothing but withdrawal the symptoms. But all this comes from a fact that is, after all, true, that the Jews were bourgeois, mostly liberal morals, that they could not understand, therefore, mass murder. It hadn't taken place. When was the last time? Maybe the Spanish Inquisition. For a long time. It's no wonder. Couldn't understand the fact of mass murder. There was really no principle, no precedent. You mustn't forget that. Couldn't understand the fact of mass murder and could not adjust. I will give you finally an example of that taken from the outside. You've all read the Diary of Anne Frank, haven't you? But what strikes one of the Diary of Anne Frank is very simple, and it reaffirms, I think, everything I've said. Here was the Frank family in Amsterdam, in their hiding. All around them were the Nazis. And what did they do? They continued a Berlin bourgeois life. There was no attempt, as Bruno Bettelheim rightly has pointed out, to learn how to flee, to learn how to survive. No attempt like that at all. They continued as best they could, under new circumstances, an old bourgeois life. That is how deeply it was ingrained. It seems today, I mean, you can hardly grasp it if you reread the Diary of Anne Frank. You can hardly grasp it that people should. There is a psychological reason. It's easier to survive if you carry on with normalcy. But it is, I think, very difficult for the attitude of the Jewish population, because you would never find a communist doing that in 20 million years. That is very typical for an essentially embourgeois mob, which lies at the root, I think, of much of that trouble. The failure of the religious leadership cannot be ignored. Rabbi Beck is a shining exception. But that must also be said, that in the camps and otherwise, the rabbis became part of the crowd. Religious leadership, all accounts agree, hardly existed. There were some heroic exceptions. There always are. Leo Peck is one, and there are some others. But by and large, there was no rabbinical leadership whatsoever. That, of course, did not exactly help, as we would say, a renaissance of Judaism. Finally, this question raises the problem, of course. What is the Jewish community? Is there a Jewish community? And it raised it under the most unfavorable circumstances. And it was not answered, because past history with its divisions was much too strong and much too dense to have it answered. The problem of Jewish resistance must be seen from this perspective. Resistance did come in the ghettos, in desperation and late. But it must, I am afraid, be argued that resistance to be effective should have come early in 1933. This is an argument for the Christian churches, for everyone, that when there was a chance to resist effectively, was the years 1933, 1934, and once nobody resisted at the beginning, the die was, as a matter of fact, cast, because the whole Nazi technique put too high a price on resistance later on. After all, a great many Germans did. You must never forget what it meant, that during the war, 5,000 Jews were hidden in Berlin. That meant that roughly 10 to 20,000 Germans, Gentile Germans, risked their life day and night at times for strangers. And when you sometimes contemplate, as you must, the question of collective German guilt, please remember that. And think whether there would be 20,000 Americans who would risk their lives for Jews as 20,000 Berliners did, and probably another 20,000 all over Germany. Because at that time, what?
How many Germans were there? 70 million?
Yeah, it's still a very heroic thing, and you wouldn't find it in most places. So what you have, therefore, is heroism in existence. That is very important to remember. And it is very important to remember that martyrs are very rare, otherwise everybody would be a martyr, and that it is very easy to smile on this in your security. But in reality, we must remember that there was heroism on the outside, and that, by the best estimate, some 30 to 40,000 Jews eventually were saved. But the only way this could be done is to refuse deportation. That is the only point, the cutoff point, where you could have vanished. And that refusal of deportation was, of course, made much more difficult by the Jewish Council and all of that sort of thing. But we must keep again the perspective that there were 20,000 people, or probably more like 30,000 people, who were willing to risk their lives. This was not just hiding people, and many of them were caught and executed. So what you have, therefore, here is resistance. Yes, there was, in the Jewish question, some German resistance at the end. There was some Jewish resistance at the end, in the ghetto. But both resistance was totally ineffective, in a sense, because it didn't come early enough. And it didn't come early enough because of that combination of Nazi techniques and the past history which we have discussed and which we shall come into. The lack of Jewish resistance is therefore painful but explainable. That must be clear. It is the product then of an interaction of Jewish history and Nazi techniques. And it is ridiculous and childish to try and make a big Jewish resistance where there was none. So that is childish, because the essence, I agree with you, this is the essence of the problem.
and you just have to face it as it was. It is not a mystery or a mystique. It is a definitely, historically explainable sequence, and out of this historical explanation comes a lack of resistance. Moreover, remember, the churches didn't resist either. Nobody really resisted. And you must not try to give the Jews some special endowment which they don't possess. Nobody resisted. Nobody resisted. So when it was effective, and then when it was too late, it was a resistance by Jewish youth, but typically not so much by those who had been through and lived on the outside a long time and had been through the previous development of history and facts. What then after the Holocaust? What after the war? How important is the Holocaust in our history that we are discussing? How much an incision is it, really? This question can only be taken up in connection with the post-war Jewish situation. And what I want to do now, in the last two lectures, next week, is I want to sum up the course, but around the problem now, which you've all been waiting for, or many of you have been waiting for, the problem of Jewish consciousness. I've already said quite a lot today about that, haven't I? But the problem of Jewish consciousness I want to use to sum up, but at the same time face the problem of the importance of the Holocaust and of Jewish development after 1945. Meanwhile, on Friday, please come and do me the favor to fill out that form and to discuss it.